longest I've ever stayed in England. I think so. Yeah. Usually coming to short, a few short days. So I'll be coming back a couple of times as I travel to other countries. But, hopefully you're looking a lot closer at the books that I'm writing and listening to more of the lectures. So Prabhupada has given us an amazing society of so many wonderful leaders, so many wonderful gurus, so many uncles, aunties, nieces, nephews, brothers and sisters. So a culture, which we are all about, spiritual culture, it involves so many aspects for them to work and to complement each other. And in a culture, each generation should feel some satisfaction, enthusiasm, should feel valued. Each family is a civilization is as strong as its families are. Each family is similar, but at the same time, different. He says there's a big picture of Vaishnava community. All those immediately then under the Saraswati family of Bhaktisiddhanta. Then we have our own institution. Prabhupada is the founder. Then in that institution, we have so many yatras and projects and different leaders who are trying to serve Prabhupada in various ways. Just as the guru is a disciple of his guru, each case is like that. Every one is a disciple. As each disciple has special personality, special karma, special idiosyncratic tendencies, still it's expected a disciple is supposed to create some teamship in serving the mission of the guru. Each of us as sannyasis, gurus, older devotees, we're all different. You can hear a class in the same verse by different leaders, and we'll all share a certain aspect of something, same but also some difference. But the beauty is when we put all those differences together and try to offer it at the lotus feet of Srila Prabhupada. But similarly, the beauty in all the disciples is that as they also work together for the general mission of Lord Chaitanya, as they maintain individuality, but as they try to collectively offer something. We're all just individuals, as GBCs, as gurus, nothing would happen. Because we have different backgrounds, we serve Prabhupada differently, we have different orientations on certain things. Some of us are conservative, some conservative on certain issues, some radical, some eclectic, it's so different. But to the degree that we're able to bring that and offer it to Prabhupada, to the degree that Prabhupada is pleased. But similarly, my disciples here, disciples all around the world, aspiring disciples, all are different. It's expected that we all offer something to Prabhupada. We all offer something to our gurus. They can offer to Srila Prabhupada. So that means whenever you're not working and somehow as a team, you're not being a good disciple. Because it means that you're allowing whatever your own concerns, issues, problems, desires be so prominent that it's the number one thing in your life. And that means that we're not really being selfless. We're not really having sufficient compassion. Because compassion can never just settle only with yourself. Nobody's compassionate just thinking only about their needs, their desires, their problems. Plus, nobody can be happy that way. It's the strangest thing that to the degree that we only think of ourselves, to the degree that we'll actually suffer more in Krishna consciousness. Because Krishna will not facilitate our, help us very much. We'll not feel much of Guru's mercy. We'll not get much inner strength. If you're thinking too much of yourself, not only will you become bored, not only will you become bewildered, but you'll even stop even following the principles. Chanting, reading, all these things, preaching will not have much value to you because if everything is yourself, then nothing else will have that much importance for you to become empowered to do or get protection or strength to be able to do it. we can do so many things in Prabhupada's service. So we just try to be more selfless. It doesn't mean denying our own identity or denying our particular needs, but it means thinking bigger than just our limited, you know, space or our limited concerns. We don't want to be just ordinary kind of people. We're just living just somehow to get something for ourselves. So even when we have relationships and associations, we're still just thinking what we can get out of it, thinking about the big me. That's a very boring life. It will not lead to much realization, not giving much strength to overcome the passions and the dictates of the senses. It'll do the opposite. It'll make you a slave of the senses. This is why also to try to help facilitate giving devotees a little more skills and what to think, how to think to become proper Vaishnavas. I requested it. You hear it again, again, again. I requested that any devotees who want to connect with me as Shiksha or Diksha, that they, you know, consider four community building principles, the four principles of self-investigation, along with the four rules and regulations. For the self-investigation, we ask that you would always try to keep a balance between your material and your spiritual life. So many devotees are in such distress now because maybe they went from one extreme or the other. They just try to focus on the material and the maintenance, and they minimize their spiritual life, they minimize association, they minimize chanting. Their life is a mess. And even if they acquire material things, still they're that much disappointed. Or they get so much into so-called submission consciousness that they don't have time to think about their wives, their children, their health. So we think you have a healthy balance. If you're going to pursue a career, if you're going to pursue some area of involvement materially, then do it well. And at the same time, don't let it take you away from your devotional life. Your form of maya gets you so much into trying to be something, do something materially. And after a while, no Krishna consciousness, put Krishna consciousness on the whole, and then later you try to get back and it becomes very hard. It's much harder, much more difficult to pick yourself up after you start falling down than to maintain some steadiness. There's thousands of devotees all around the world who've gotten so loose and fallen down, they keep thinking, I'm going to try to get more serious later, and the maya keeps finding ways to hold them down. We ask you not to be sectarian, but at the same time to be chaste. Don't be condescending to other religions. Don't be sectarian, you know, within our own society. Don't be sectarian thinking my guru and how about your guru, or thinking that my institution and, you know, other institutions have no value. No. There is so much value in so many situations. There's so many things you can learn. You shouldn't just think I only can listen to my guru's tapes, read my guru's books, get my guru's instructions. It's cultism. Yes, you get your major cues from your guru, but you get all kinds of special things from other teachers, what they say is most important from our founder, Acharya. So chase, in that sense, we expect the same thing in our disciple-guru relationship. There's loyalty, but there's not, you know, fanaticism. And we expect you, we're asking all of our, those who come in touch with us for directions, that we go the extra mile for trying to facilitate women and children. There's been too much of an imbalance in our institution in minimizing the care of children and creating almost like a subculture or casteism, relegating women to almost like second class citizens while we hide behind so-called Vedic culture. So, you know, we expect that there's self-investigation on these things. We don't take it, you know, too lightly, and that we realize that if you feel that you want to be inspired by me in some way, and these things are required. Otherwise, you know, better you align in other places or other situations where there's more emphasis in other areas. No problem. But if we're going to accept the teacher, then we have to understand how the teacher teaches, what that teacher, you know, expects. And then you should remind yourself of four community principles. We ask that when you are having any kind of conflict, that you first take it home, take it to yourself. You look at yourself first as being the one at fault. At fault that you didn't communicate your situation better. At fault that you were misunderstood, you see how to present it better. Or at fault because you are at fault. Now, just think, well, this person doing this, this person doing that. Yeah, maybe so, but what is it about you that has caused or added to that situation? What is it about you that hasn't been strong enough to help the other person to be able to, you know, to be better? And emphasize that. First, you start from there. You start off with considering, what could you have done? What situation, how could you have behaved differently? Or what can you now do? Try to bring some kind of resolution. You start with yourself first. And that is good because it's not artificial. It's really trying to be more the servant of the servant. It's trying to be more mindful of what our actions mean and produce to others. And it's also realizing that reality is also perception. Because even if somebody perceives something and it's not fully true, they will act upon it and they will do things based on what their perception is. If somebody has a perception of you that's unhealthy, even though you're doing everything right, you still have a duty to try to minimize them having having an unhealthy perception. Again, if you only care about yourself, then none of this matters. You just think, I don't like this person does this, this person is wrong, and it bothers me, the hell with it. Or then you have criticism with them and that's it. Or you make enemies and friends, or you hold grudges. But that's very mundane. It's just acting like normal sense gratifiers. Vaishnavas are supposed to be so concerned about others, and so concerned about avoiding Vaishnava aparad. And we don't. You know, we just want higher realization. And we'll even leave devotional service after a while. It won't be working for us. Then we ask you to think about someone or those who you love the most. We try to extend that to everybody. There's somebody in your life who you have great love and affection for. But now try to have that more, that you can see it and place it on everyone, so that you're just surrounded with this mood of connecting with some loving type of catalyst, because you're seeing, you're trying to appreciate Krishna in everyone. You're trying to see behind whatever the immediate action is. Understand that whatever's going on, even when somebody is in all kind of anxiety and somebody's acting in an obnoxious way, you're not just going to settle in on that level. You're trying to see what is the real need there, what is the cry, what's behind causing this person to act this way. So you can still think good of the individual, or still recognizing that they need to have some help. And then we ask you to try to consider that whoever you associate with, thinking in the mood that this is determining the success or failure of my spiritual life. Each encounter you have with each person that you're thinking that this is the success or failure of my spiritual life based on how I deal with this individual. We're trying to make Krishna consciousness real. It's so embarrassing. You know, I'm traveling all over the world with my disciples and in this society in general. It's just so embarrassing to see so many people who read so many books, who know so many slokas, who attend so many artics, chant so many rounds, and they have horrible habits. They're offensive toward each other. Because they haven't really settled, taken the philosophy, the essence seriously, in their heart. And it's so sad to see so many people who are in this society, who are on medication, who are depressed, who are suicidal. They're not, why? Why is it? It's something that's supposed to make us so happy, supposed to help us to have greater understanding about everything, something given to us, the highest philosophy on the planet. Why we find so much, you know, dysfunctionalism? That's because we're just too mechanical. We're not really imbibing and reassessing and, you know, enlivening ourselves on what we have. We're having it, we're excited at first, then we kind of coast with it like a duty, like a job. It doesn't work for us. Why do we have more people who have left the society than who have stayed? Think about it. We have thousands, tens of thousands of people who join the movement. And each year, people leave. Each year, so many people flee. Each year, so many people wind up hating this movement. And in some cases, even doubting whether Krishna exists. You'd be surprised how many Gurukula kids born in this movement who are now atheists. It makes no sense. Somebody who's born in such a society, exposed to so much spiritual lifestyle, and now they're really questioning whether they even believe there's a God. Not only questioning whether the movement itself is of value, or questioning, you know, because of some confusion of leadership or institutional things, some other internal problems, they even question whether there's even a God. Not even Krishna, but they question whether there's even a God at all. You don't believe. So that means that somehow that we have to look closer at ourselves, see what we're bringing into the society, what we're adding to it or what we are taking away. Or we have to look at ourselves and consider, maybe we're going to be the next person like that. After so many years, and this I feel like I'm wasting my time. After so many years, find ourselves on the same platform of consciousness basically that we were the first year that we joined. And in some cases, and we find ourselves even less pious and ethical than we were when we initially joined. Some people loop, and they go back, but they become even more sense gratifiers than they were even before they joined Krishna consciousness. Why? It's not that the philosophy doesn't work. Why? If we are not happy in our spiritual life, then it means something about us is not working. We're not doing something proper. Nothing wrong with the philosophy. You can't blame it on somebody else. There's always people and issues and things that's going to be distracting and challenging. But we're so weak that we allow such things to cause us not to access our devotion, then that's our own disempowerment and foolishness. So then we ask that you consider people you're associating with, you know, people you're living with, people who you should know, they should know you, to be impacting upon each other's consciousness, to remind each other of Krishna. To consider these people that you may very likely leave your body with. Because this is our life. Our identity is Vaishnavas. Many times, particular countries, the projects that we're in, relationships we have, these are the people that are going to be with you, helping to develop your creeper, your focus that's going to determine what happens when you leave the body. In some cases, they're going to be the immediate people around you when you leave, helping to enhance your journey. In some cases, they may be stagnating your journey. Imagine you're leaving your body, you got to be around someone. Somebody's around you, you get all this grudge and anxiety with, it's going to affect your transcendence. Somebody who you really haven't opened your heart up to, it's going to affect you in different ways. So, you know, don't let us just, you know, hear about these things as like just some kind of axioms or theories that really don't have any relevance to us. We're trying to help us so that we have the philosophy and we experience the philosophy more, and we do not allow ourselves to become another casualty. Just today, when I went to just one of that program, what basically was I associating with? You know, I mean, they were trying. But basically, every person there was someone who, for some reason, had become disgruntled with the institution, was not formally connected. In many cases, they've gone outside, taken initiation other places. Other cases, they've taken more shelter, new age stuff. And several of them smoking, taking drugs, and so many things. But then people, many of them have been involved in devotional service for so many years. Prabhupada disciples have been around for a long time. And now, their lives are so unhappy. Because once you have this kind of knowledge, you can't just kind of go back and be an ordinary sense gratifier. Or if you just, you know, you dabble in a little bit of metaphysics, you dabble in this religion, you dabble in this thing, that is not the same. Because once you have Krishna consciousness, we have so much other deeper understanding about things. So then, you know, what happens is like some of them are just having to take shelter of drugs because they're just suffering and kind of medicating themselves with the drug. That can happen to some of us. Because many of them, they started off like some of you. Their first one enthused, then they start taking things, you know, mechanically. Start taking things for granted. In some cases, they start making offenses toward others. In other cases, they just get over preoccupied with whatever was negative in the society. And then they become, you know, void of any enthusiasm to be able to live Krishna consciousness in a higher way, you know, themselves. And then they just kind of coast and, you know, hope somehow some kind of miracle is going to happen, things are going to change in their lives. And it's very sad. There are just thousands of people like that who didn't take proper shelter of the process. And now it's like their life has become unsuccessful. And what will happen is when they die, they have to come back take more births, and in many cases they'll have to deal with some of the same kind of problems that they failed in the last time. Like you're in school and you don't pass a test. Not only did you have waste time, you got to go back, but you still got to take some of the same tests. So you still have a chance that you may fail again. The better to apply yourself, do the necessary, get out of that class, because at some point one still has to deal with, you know, with that lesson. So anyway, my point is that do try to be beyond the point, the platform of just mechanically doing a devotional service. Do try to go beyond the platform, just thinking about yourself. Do try to rise above just getting distracted by your problems or people's problems. Do try to avoid, you know, getting too distracted by whatever Maya may be coming out. That and you just accept it as that and get distracted. Try to understand also what's behind why somebody is acting or perceiving this way. What you can do to make a difference. If you can't make a difference, at least don't slow down in your devotional life. And you can be a barometer. What can you see? Am I enthusiastically chanting my rounds? Am I enthused when I read? Am I enthused as I listen to tapes? Am I eager to try to finish my housework, finish this service, so that I can read? Am I constantly allowing my spiritual master's messages ringing in my mind? Am I constantly thinking when I do my activities and duties, how would my spiritual master feel knowing what I'm doing or not doing? And where we can emphatically say, yes, Guru will be pleased. And we know that. Spiritual life is going on for us, at leaps and bounds. When we have to question and wonder, the Guru will be happy about this. What to say when we can distinctly know that, wow, Guru surely would not be pleased by how I'm arguing, by the fact that I'm not chanting, the fact that I'm not reading, that I'm not having any time to go for association in the temple, be with the devotees. The Guru will be happy in knowing that basically all I do is just think about myself, what I want, what I don't want, what I can get, what I hope to get later. And that's all that I do is just function like such an ordinary, selfish person. Guru will be happy and knowing that I'm breaking the four principles that connects us as Vaishnavas to the Parampara. The Guru knows that even though he's talking and writing about all this stuff, traveling all around the world, talking about community building and relationships, trying to help so many different projects, that his own disciples just take it so lightly. What a bluff. What's the value of teaching all of this? And his own disciples just take it all. We've heard it many times. So I'm leaving on Monday. I go to France. And I'll give some courses there. It's like at Soho, I gave a course on releasing fear and embracing love. I talked a little bit in the manner on the leadership. And in Ireland, I gave a course on transforming anger. Dealing with really, you know, issues that confront us every day. That can be anatta, so help us to rise above anatta nibbati. And then, of course, in Italy, I spoke somewhat about careers and people taking more understanding of the idea of Prabhupada as a cultural ambassador, taking the best from the West and East, putting it, you know, together. And we discussed some things about, you know, demonic influence, like last night. We talked about demons and ghosts and all kind of crazy stuff like that. But looking at the fact that all of this is part of the existence and all kind of things that we want to be careful for, we're getting protection and not that we are allowing ourselves to be products of deviation. Then today, I gave a 2.5-hour class or so, course, out there. It's nice. It was like a farm, organic farm, big field. And many devotees had come staying for a week. They had put up tents and built a temple. It's interesting. And most, they said, were devotees who used to be very active in ISKCON, but no longer are such. And we tried to speak to them about an interactive workshop dealing with how to access miracles in our lives. First, how to recognize the miracles that's already taken place. So we see how Krishna has already helped us in so many ways. And then how to be to put ourselves in a better position where we're having more of Krishna's blessings and divine intervention taking place. And it was a way to try to help them in building up their faith, a way to help them to feel that Krishna had not abandoned them. We gave them some interactive things to discuss and to share. And then we did a guided meditation, try to help to really, to take them from some, to break some karmic patterns. Several people were crying. They were having to process, look closer at what's going on in their lives. So much pain and sadness when we don't follow the process properly. And we do. We struggle, but we become happy because we have more internal connection with Guru and Krishna. So, when I leave on Monday, go to France, and then to Bosnia, to Croatia, Ukraine, and many other CIS countries, and later Africa, Mexico. But I'll be doing similar, a lot of courses, trying to meet up with disciples at the same time, and also trying to kind of create a silent revolution. My books now, you know, are so popular that, you know, right now, in terms of sales, that second to Prabhupada's books, my books are the most popular in the world. Like in Russia, they're printing 20,000, you know, copies of different titles at one time. Croatia, I have all my books in Croatia, and so many different languages now. They'll gradually be in about 13 languages. And I always say different about how many books I have out, because I have so many books already written that we haven't edited yet. So maybe by this year it's over, we have maybe four more books in print or three more books in print. We have several other books that are finished. They just haven't come out. Another book will be coming out in 3 weeks that Amla Dasi, David Dasi, wrote the foreword to. This is the Reflections number 3 on the Harinam Chintamani. Then we have the Reflections 4 in Sri Upanishad, which the major work will be finished in 2 weeks. And then we go through all the round one and round two editing. And then we have Spiritual Warrior 5 and 6. That's all about, 4 and 5 rather, it's all about some of the kind of things I'm doing workshops on now. There's a depression, and grief, and suicide, and anger, all of these things. Enemies of the mind. So those we hope to have ready and printed in December, or by the end of this year. Then we are working on Spiritual Warrior 6 right now, which is about war, violence, terrorism. Then we have initial work happening now on Reflections 5, which will be 64 principles of Bhakti Siddhanta that he gives, you know, for addressing community. Anyway, there's just so many situations where we can have some things available, you know, like this. And so that means that more people will be reading the books. More people are going to be looking also to see, well, is this stuff really relevant? What's the need for writing? We have Prabhupada's books already. But we also have Bodhisattva's books. We have Gaurav Kishore's books. We have Bhakti Vinod's books. But we still, the present leaders also write. We also speak Bhagavad Gita, Sri Chaitanya, even though we have the message and the purports of Srila Prabhupada. We still give our own purports based on our realizations and the relevance of today's time and place. But see, because I'm writing so many social, psychological, spiritual things about individual development and community, first people want to see, does Maharaj really live this? And does his disciples really understand this? And if they don't see that, then all this writing won't even mean as much. If another person's writing some ego trip, writing something, just to print books and sell money, make money off books or something. But if people, you know, it's like in Russia, my devotees, they meet disciples, there are so many new disciples there. And they meet, you know, once a month, they get together in all over different places in CIS. And they're inspiring so many projects. Because when the leaders see, oh, when my disciples come together, and they check in on each other, they help each other, support each other, they come together as teams to do some service at the temples, take various types of projects. Then the leaders are amazed because disciple meetings are all open for anyone who comes. So they're sending their disciples, some of the leaders come, and they say that is having a big improvement and upliftment, uplifting some of the projects. anywhere that people see my high distinct disciples, they should first see that they have very loving Vaishnava relationships. You don't have that, you're not being a proper disciple. They should see that you are not sectarian. At the same time, you are focused. They should see that you're really valuing others and trying to be the servant of the servant. And the best way we can serve our gurus is to be good disciples. The best way I can serve Prabhupada is really to represent so much of what he has given. And people will think, oh yes, they'll feel better about my spiritual master. So many people now, in other religions, even other Vaishnava groups, they really don't think so well of Prabhupada anymore. Because they see so many bad examples, you know, from our devotees. In Vrindavan and some of the holy lands, so many people have now bad opinions about the movement and about Prabhupada. When they see so many devotees who are not acting proper, who are, you know, seemingly not trained, and they do various things, and they consider, okay, this has to do with the potency or lack of potency of this organization. So we'll become an embarrassment to Srila Prabhupada. But how wonderful it is when people see that, oh yes, look how Prabhupada's children and grandchildren are doing. They realize, oh, this is very special, Acharya. He's helped the world in such a special way. So we ask that you try to read at least 1 hour a day. You know, some of you don't have a chance to have class in temple so much. That means you're still very obligated to be able to read and to hear something, so you're able to have more protection as you go out through the course of the day. So listen to a lecture or read something. At least see that 1 hour a day, you're finding some way to concentrate on Shastra. That it carries you through. When there's chances, be sure to take advantage of having darshan of the deities, you know, coming to the temples. We ask that you write, you know, that you write us. Try to connect more with the website, with the BT Swami e-group. Here's an amazing chance to use technology to be able to be in touch with God brothers and God sisters and disciples from all around the world. There's no reason why one should just be alone or feel alone or not be able to share their mind with others. There's no reason why one should not be in contact. We don't have to physically be with you, but you can be so much in contact by reading the tour reports and keeping in touch, you know, with each other. It's only come now to so many places, you know, just once a year, and that's it. But there's no reason why we can't still, you know, be very much in touch. But let's see what questions that you might have. We're not expecting anything that's too difficult.
How exactly do you define deep loving relationships? I mean, could you give us like a picture of what would it be?
Yeah, it's not, you know. Say, well, you know, Guru Maharaj said we should have deep loving relationships. So, me and you, we should have love, lust. No, it means that we're really concerned about the other person's spiritual progress. And we're going outside of our comfort zone as we interact with each other. That we're really trying to think about that person as a spiritual entity. Concerned about, you know, their spiritual growth. That we are very happy to see them progress. And we are sad to see them in distress. And there's love, and there's this deep feeling about the person's well-being, deep anxiety about things that's not going right for them. And we try to see what we can do to help to see that things are going right. So we are to be more Krishna conscious ourselves, so that we can impact on someone else and helping them to think more about Krishna. You know, we hear that word get thrown around so much, love, love, love. That doesn't mean very much to most people. Because it's often used, you know, to manipulate, or it's used to talk about lust. But it's what we're really about. What Krishna consciousness really entails. So it means really trying to appreciate others and less thinking only about oneself. Not self-denial, not low self-esteem. Just having so much more appreciation for Krishna appearing and manifesting in others.
Just one thing in terms of, you talked about the whole course you gave on how to recognize miracles. So how do we tell if we have a genuine realization in Krishna consciousness or something that's a miracle as opposed to something which may be our mind or which we're...
We don't. He's asking, said, I gave this course on miracles. It was really about how to recognize excess miracles in your life. It was mainly to help them to realize that they shouldn't be just in the cynical mood because they've already had many miracles. Krishna brought them to Krishna consciousness. He's helped them in so many ways. Krishna is still there. Even if you get disturbed with so many other things, don't lose faith in Krishna. But you're looking at it from a different perspective. How do we recognize something as a miracle rather than just some speculation of whether it's genuine? That we relate everything based on Shastra. Real miracle is something that's helped us to become freer of sense gratification. Otherwise, you know, what is it about? It just helps us to enjoy more and become more in illusion with mature energy. What's the value? Other questions? Krishna keeps kicking you. The question is, how many kicks will you have to have before you really decide, okay, enough is enough. I need to get out of this way that I'm living. Some people, it takes many, many, many kicks, even many lifetimes, and finally they realize, hold it, I don't have to suffer like this by staying here, letting you kick me, Maya, and get away from you. But Maya's kicking us. It's a sign that we're staying too much in her realm of contact. We're not getting sufficient shelter from Krishna. So even maturely speaking, that usually for accomplishing something, we have to endeavor. We have to commit. We have to persevere. We have to train. We have to practice. And then we become something. So we shouldn't think, although that's in every area of life, that in Krishna consciousness, we can just somehow just wait for Krishna's mercy to descend on us and help us to have strength, make a change in our lives. We have to do like we do in any other area. And we have to persevere, and we have to strategize. We have to be around people who are more expert. We have to learn from them. It's like, you know, some months ago there was the Olympics, the World Olympics. Now, most of those who won the gold have been practicing and practicing for years and years. Some of them since little kids were training. And every day, practically, they do some practice. They come from school, their life is centered around some practice. And it took that kind of effort to become the world's best, or the world's second or third best. But along with that dedication, most of the best were also trained by some of the best. They had the desire, they persevered, and they also got instructions. And so because of that, then there they were, able to be so outstanding. The best musician, dancers, singers, doesn't matter. Yes, they can often be born with some talent, but still there has to be refinement and practice. And when they do like that, so many will have a chance to reach an amazing level of excellence. And there's some others who have a desire to be great. They get the instruments, they get the equipment, they practice a little bit, they put it away. It will never be the same. They get the best teachers, but they don't take advantage of the message sufficiently. Even though they have the best teachers, sometimes the best facility, they still won't accept. Because you just can't get something for nothing. Or to say, you know, spiritual. So even though we see that sometimes more secularly, when it comes to spiritual life, we're kind of thinking, it's just supposed to happen. Krishna is supposed to just make it happen. Why should he make it happen? We're not doing what's necessary for it to happen. We struggle with so many things. anything that any of us want really bad, we struggle for it like hell. But when it comes to serving Krishna or Guru, a little bit of distraction and we lose faith, we lose determination. When it's something we personally want, we dream about it, we sacrifice, put a little money aside until we get it. There's a computer you want, you don't have the money for it. And the pair of shoes, the sari you want, you don't have the money for it. But you're thinking about it, and you keep pursuing some plan until you get it. Put a little money aside, you may have to borrow, but you get it because it's what you want. When we want something, in genuine sense, we don't get too bothered by distractions, we just find a way how to get around that distraction and still be able to get it. We can do that for ourselves when it comes to Krishna. Somebody want a car, sometimes they don't even have it in their budget. They just find a way to save and save, and they found it, they can get a car. You know? They'll do that for themselves. Inconvenience themselves. Sometimes work two jobs. Huh? Really hard. Take very little vacations. Work overtime. But when it comes to Krishna, 1-2 hours of chanting, too much work. A little time to go to the temple, come to disciple meetings, to read, chant our Gayatris. Very little time. If we do have time, we just kind of work it in. We tolerate it like it's an imposition in our lives. And we expect that somehow we're going to become great. We're going to become high achievers. No. A person who doesn't really apply themselves for practice is not going to be a good dancer. Even if they have talent, some things they have to refine. A person who does like that is not going to be the best athlete. Because they haven't gone through the pain of practice of becoming better by learning more from failure sometimes and from good training. Other questions?
How do we root the philosophy of Krishna consciousness more in the heart? And when you speak about the heart, how do you define that? I mean, because we know about the intelligence and mind. What is the heart? How do we know it's coming from the heart?
When it's only in the mind, we accept one day, enthusiastically, we can reject the next day just as enthusiastic. Because it's just something based on what is seemingly is logical and rational to us. And there's so many things in Krishna consciousness that doesn't always come across logically. It's super extraordinary. We go far beyond the normal logical platform. If we accept on the mind and the intellect, we'll be accepting when it's convenient to accept. And when it's not, the mind will go other places. Anyone else? It doesn't mean that we should approach it without trying to study and understand. The intellect should dive into it. We should know that it's really beyond our intellect. At the same time, we use our intellect as a catalyst. It's bigger. Krishna consciousness is much more this basic intellectual understanding. Here, this week we bring them up on the same page. In Soho, and part of the workshop, I was showing the power of internal dialogue. That many times we are doing something and even saying something, but we're thinking differently. And that we're much more about what we're thinking than what we're performing. You really did a really nice bhajan, you know, last night. But your mind is really saying, you think you're wonderful. You think you're a professional musician. And you know you took so long, chanting for such a long time. Why you let somebody else chant for a while? So you're saying one thing, but you're really thinking something totally different. So often, the stuff that's going on in our minds is actually at a distance or unhealthy and negative. And when it's negative, it causes us to minimize our spirituality. It's like what I was talking a little while ago. Some of you were thinking, yeah, I've heard that. Some of you were thinking, oh, you can speak like that. He's a sannyasi. You can speak in a detached way. See, the problem is somebody else's. But, you know, if he was a householder, having to deal with some of these people, you're going to be talking like that. You see? So, something else is going on in the mind. You know, while you're hearing, even nodding, something else is going on in the mind. Something is going on in the mind thinking. It's easy to talk like that. Easy to think that way. But when it comes down to action, somebody has fried you out. Somebody has caused you, you know, some problem. It's not so easy to think, well, I'm the problem. Now how do I approach it from that way? You just think, I'm mad, I'm angry, I'm disturbed. How could you say that to me? How could you do that to me? Why you do that stuff all the time? I don't like it. Therefore, get out of my face. Yeah, but it's not so hard. It's only hard if we have already brought closure thinking that it's hard. We're not ready to entertain anything else. We're not ready to entertain something that we can't go beyond. But it's not that hard. Because if we can accept one way of thinking, we can also accept another way. We don't have to be locked into one way of thinking. If we stay too locked in, we're torturing ourselves. I'm sorry. Oh, yes. Yes, it just helps us become more mindful, more in control of our lives, noticing better what's really going on in our consciousness. And, you know, we can't just stop it, because the mind is always going to be picking things up. As we become more mindful, we then process things differently. Or stuff that's coming, we don't take it as serious. Either accepting it or getting too worried about trying to reject it. We realize, okay, I'm really not going to keep this as a mantra. Because most people's internal dialogue is over 70% negative. Thinking bad about somebody else, thinking about what they can't do, what didn't happen, what should have happened, how they're going to make a fool of themselves, thinking about, you know, other people not appreciating them, somebody maybe saying something. You have all this speculation and all this focus on what can go wrong rather than what can go right or what is happening.
You mentioned with the and choosing love over fear, you said we should name it, face it, feel it, and release it. What does it mean to feel it? What does it mean to release it? And how do we know when we've actually released ourselves from some of a certain negative pattern? How can we be sure? Because you said in the darshan that sometimes we think we've forgiven someone but we actually haven't. How do we know when we've actually done it?
I gave a formula of addressing conflicts and problems in our lives and with other people by trying to name what's going on, be honest about what's happening. So, and then to face it, either with our own self or with someone else, but in a thoughtful way. And then to feel it, because sometimes we're out of touch of our feelings. We're repressing our feelings. And after we are able to do that, then they'll be able to then to release it. You have to grab it, identify with it, to get it out. Now, a gross example, we got a rat in the kitchen, a rat in the house. So, somehow, you realize food is being eaten, there's rats still around, because there is a rat. So you find a way, you have a box, and you trap it, you catch it, you face it. You take it out, get rid of it. So sometimes we have to deal with the reality that there's actually rats too. That means there's a rat around. Food paper is being chewed up. Not going to denial. Not overreact. You realize, okay, I'm disturbed by this. It's contaminating the food. It's bring sickness. But then you think conscientiously how to confront it. You get it out.
But how do we know we've released something? How do we know that we've become free of a certain
problem? Let's set an example. Of somebody who's hurt us, or of our own, anartha.
Yeah, just someone who's or.
How do we know we release?
Yeah, how do we know we're free?
We've forgiven someone. Well, we can know we've forgiven someone when we can now be able to very easily think of their well-being. We haven't forgiven. Just thinking or hearing about them puts us in some anxiety. Puts us in a mood of wanting revenge or wanting to avoid or be away from that person or feeling that the person should suffer in some way for what they did to us. So we have really forgiven. We have taken that salt that has happened in that person out of our consciousness, we're ready to say yes for the present, or we learn from the past. We're not going to be unloving because somebody else's stuff is weighing us down. We're not going to void our spirituality because somebody else's got some negative stuff. At the same time, we can think of the person in a real caring way. Even sometimes, the issue that has confronted us, instead of being angry, we feel more kind of sadness for the person, that they are hurting their own spiritual life. But when we can't feel good about that person, it's a sign we haven't released. With wanting, you know, plotting revenge, it's a sign we haven't forgiven. Sometimes when we're experiencing too much anxiety, like ulcers and sometimes other kinds of issues of stress, can often mean that we are repressing some anxiety based on what somebody has done to us, you know, and we haven't released it. Yeah, if you're getting constant flashbacks or periodic flashbacks, it's a sign that you haven't released it enough. You have to go deeper in order to be able to release it. Because it means there's still so much dwelling in the psyche, still producing some trauma, still, you know, imposing into your consciousness. Because of that, every now and then it surfaces. If you find you're getting flashbacks and it's causing some anxiety, then you have to accept that whatever the person was and whatever he or she did to you is due to their own dysfunctionalism. And you wish them well. You don't have to associate, you know, with them. You're not accepting that it wasn't as bad as it was. But you're accepting that you're not going to allow whatever bad or evil that person did constantly attack you day after day by still thinking about it and by still carrying it. That's kind of normal, that the body will be pulling in different ways. And sometimes, based on things that we really don't fully want. If we really don't want it, Krishna will give us the strength to not to act upon it. But if we think we don't want it, and really we have these strong inner desires for it, then there's a chance that we may fall prey. So one of the ways we can deal with that is to be more prayerful, so that we strengthen our inner resolve, strengthen our inner dialogue. We focus our prayers more powerfully, asking Krishna to help us to remove obstacles and blocks that interfere with our spiritual progress. And then we'll send various types of help.
You mentioned in one lecture how we shouldn't disregard people. We should also be selective about who we associate and how we associate. Could you give some practical tips on what we should look for in terms of the association we have with devotees? And also, how are we to, you know, regard devotees or read devotees, if that's what you want to
do? Well, Narada Muni explains like this. The Narada Pancharatna. He explains that when we're in a so-called inferior position, we should be eager to hear from authorities or superiors. When we are with peers, we should be eager to share our minds and serve with them. When we are in a superior position, we should be eager to reach out and to help. So in all these situations, our consciousness should be, how can we serve? Be a servant.
But amongst peers, how do we discriminate who our peers should be?
Give me some of this. Amongst peers, we should take a humble position, but still we should look to try to connect more with those who hopefully we can learn something from. if we're not able to learn so much, we should connect situations where we can share and give something. See, basically, it's really healthy if in our associations we're either learning something or we are teaching or giving something. Otherwise, it's somewhat a waste of time. We should be learning something, even studying and preparing to learn to give or directly give. If you are in a situation where the house is on fire, we just settle in, take things for granted, got to get comfortable. No. You try to get out, and hopefully you try to warn other people, get up. It's like that. But your world is hellish, it's on fire, and so you should be preparing to leave, making arrangements to escape. Anyone else? Doesn't mean to be so unhealthy, anxious all the time. We're just on edge. No. But it means to be really taking things mindfully and also looking for opportunity for growth. And materially speaking, means looking, or spiritually speaking, it means looking to see how to escape. Take another birth. How to escape from being attacked by Maya. How to escape from the next blow that Maya is preparing to throw at you. So we take shelter then. The scriptures. Shelter of association. Shelter of the holy names.
Sorry? How do we, because you're going to give a lecture, a course written in the False Ego. Could you give some practical tips on what we can do to actually minimize or release ourselves from false ego patterns?
Yeah, you know, read my Beggar 2 a little better. But also, I have recorded some workshops I gave on false ego. So you can order those from the Tate Ministry. It's very intense because we make people really have to look at themselves. And we have people to become so much more aware of what others' perception and feelings are about them. It's a real kind of a come clean type of workshop. Touch people's buttons. I was going to do it in Soho, actually. Then I changed my mind. That may be a little too heavy for something. Take a lighter topic. Since I didn't give that one in Italy. When I gave in Soho, I was going to give that in Italy. But since I didn't, you know. That was only for a few days in Italy, and things are already going on. I thought better just to say a few things to facilitate the other speakers. Should it help us to create more consolidated front of presentation?
So one of my friends was discussing with me how beauty is like practice of Krishna consciousness. When his intelligence decides to do something, his mind and heart just goes on with his intelligence. And I find that I don't have that so much. Although the intelligence is there, it's like it's hard to pull the mind and the heart in line with that. How do we align the intelligence, and how do we align our mind and our heart with our intelligence, so the whole of us, when we do something, it's done with our full being?
It's a process, it's practice. Because we first kind of mentally, intellectually understand something. The different levels of how deep we can understand that. The mind and intellect. Then we have to involve, you know, our bodies, our senses. And even with that, we have to pray for mercy. You know, then there can be, you know, a nice alignment. See, the fact that so many people fall down is a sign that they understand, maybe intellectually, but, you know, but that it's not so deep, that it's able to cause them not to fall prey, you know, to some deviation. And that's just scare the devotees. You see people who are real scholars. In some cases, Prabhupada's secretaries and servants, some of them were, you know, amazing scholars. And it's good to be a scholar, especially if you have that, you know, if you have that propensity, you should really work with it. Otherwise, the mind won't be fully engaged, and that'll cause you to come into the maya. But amazing, sometimes some people can know so much, then fall prey. Such simple sense of gratification. And in some cases, you start taking things for granted after a while. In other cases, so much of what is done is a performance, and then underlining is a whole lot of weeds and anarthas and selfishness and ulterior motivations. And because we can't cheat Krishna, and we have those improper desires, they surface in different ways. We can't bribe Krishna. We can't say, okay, Krishna, I did Mangala Arati now. Be happy. Okay, Krishna, I help organize the festival, so I'm a good devotee. Okay, Krishna, I just finished reading the Bhagavatam, so bless me. Give me some mercy. Let me hear your flute. He's looking to see, yeah, but what other stuff are you holding back? You may have done this. Look at all the other things that you did during that day that you didn't do properly. Or you did this, but what were you really thinking about? Were you really absorbed in trying to be the servant of the servant? Or were you doing certain things because you want people to see and think of you as a big devotee? There's a difference. Okay, any last question?
Is it some other topic?
So in your case also, you have to leave tomorrow or the next day?
Tuesday.
Oh, Tuesday. Yeah. It's Gopal Desa tomorrow.
Okay. 6 days ago, in Korea, the biggest company's president committed suicide.
Which company?
The Hyundai.
A very big company.
Yeah. It's like, in Japan there is Sony, in Korea there is Hyundai.
Oh, it's huge.
And, all of a sudden, the whole country
was shocked.
Is in shock. So yesterday,
he's one of the most successful men in the country,
yeah.
And he's miserable.
And then, I was thinking, because I was shocked also, and the shock keep ringing in my ear, so I was thinking that if my relatives or my close friend or like this, if they come to suicide, if I get this shock, then how much painful or how much depressed I am.
Yeah.
So I was thinking this, so... My question is, how to get over this kind of shock? Or how to help them who is in shock?
Like it's good to have the shock, but to use it. To have the shock, help you to realize, wow, people can go so high and be so successful, maturely speaking, and be in so much anxiety. People can be so successful and get and do all the things that is supposedly will make one happy. And that success can cause them to be in a worse situation than they were before they even became successful. In this new book that I have coming out, I have one section on CEO depression, or the depression that chief operation officers or chairmen and presidents of boards and presidents of countries, they have special kind of depression. One, they have the Great Depression because being highly on the top can be very lonely. Being highly on the top can cause you to be in so much anxiety because every time people want you to perform at the same level. Some entertainers go crazy. They do really good. Even though they did good, if they go out next month and they don't perform nicely, people are angry at them. Huh? People will boo them, spit on them almost. Even though they've been so good. Every time they go out, they have to go out. They have to be even better or just as good. And so much tension. But sometimes these people who become so successful, thinking that success is going to bring happiness, and then it doesn't, then they get so bored, pride, angry, disturbed. So now, for them, what else is there? For the person who doesn't have anything, they can always be in anxiety, thinking, I just got to get a better job, I have to get a raise, I have to go to Europe, go to America, go to Australia. Go to India, do this, do that, and I'll be happy. Learn this sport, learn this art. Might even do all of those things. And I look around and think, I don't want to do this. This is not fulfilling. That is not fulfilling. Why live? So what you can do is realize even more, while you're fortunate, you're sticking to a spiritual lifestyle. You can also help people who are too much ingrained, who are materialism, in considering that it's not the ultimate source. But what is life if you have so much, so many toys, so many objects, so many material things, but you're still so internally bankrupt? And some of the most very blown out people are often those who are so-called really successful, because they have what others want. And there's no adventure, challenge, inspiration in their lives. So here this person, either, I mean, obviously there was some intense frustration. Either he got so bored, so disappointed with what success was, or they may find later that there was some deviation that was going on. He took his life because of embarrassment. Because so much in the Asian countries, there's more pressure on looking good and performing. So when someone is called out, life is like over for them. It's so miserable. Now, there could be some other issue there. In the time, you know, some things will come out. But what definitely was there, that whatever happened, he became so obsessed with it, so bothered, that he couldn't even consider the pain of that or the discovery of that. So he looked at his own life. And here's a person who, you know, could have flown around the world in his own private jet, stay in any place he wants, you know, have money to buy almost anything that he wants presently. Person who millions of people would envy, and wasn't happy. Very sad. Any last question? I think we'll stop. It's a chant in a way of considering that Krishna is watching us also. We should chant and serve in the mood. This is my chance today to go back to the spiritual world. What I do today can determine whether I go back home or not. I'm interacting with this person can determine. And it does, because some of those exchanges, there's going to be death come upon us. And we never know when it may be. So at the end of the day, you can be tired and anxiety about how much service you did, or how much you thought of Krishna, or how you were trying to be caring about, you know, the relationships that you have with others. Then each night, one can have some kind of gratitude that they made certain sacrifices, use their time wise, you know, for Krishna. Or you can be in gratitude that you were so engaged in some way that you didn't have a chance to do everything in that day. That's a blessing. It's almost like a curse to go from day to day and not to have any real commitment other than just what you want to do yourself. Maybe more comfortable doing that. Even temporarily a little more peaceful. But it's not more spiritual. We should be trying to think of how we take care of our children, how we take care of our wife, our husband, how we try to live as healthy devotees. Because that becomes our biggest preaching. Our biggest preaching, so people see that devotees are materially, psychologically, and spiritually healthy. They say, wow, you guys got such a loving family. You got such beautiful kids. You and your wife seem to have a wonderful relationship. What's your secret? They want to know. If I do what you do, can I have that kind of relationship? It'll be eager. But if they see, oh my God, the other night I heard you guys arguing. Every few days I hear you shouting at each other. Your children look so spaced out. The car is falling apart. The house is unclean. You think they'll be eager about you as a person and the philosophy that you're associating with? I think whatever you do, I don't like it. Because I see that the kind of person you are that's something that I want to be like. That's something that I want to become. So, this is the biggest preaching. Our own good examples. And it's the biggest way that we sabotage Prabhupada's movement. By not having better role models. See, you know, I mean, face it. In the final analysis, people are selfish. They want something for themselves. They want something good for themselves. So that's okay in one sense. That if we can show them that spiritual life is something good for them, then many people will want to take it. They see spiritual life as something that's going to give them some things better than what they are pursuing. It's going to give them some happiness. It's going to give them peace. It's going to give them some inner, really real inner fulfillment. Then many, many people will join our society. People study our movement now. And they study here in England. I told you guys some time back we did this little survey of married couples in England who had married, you know, several years ago when they came to the movement. So we looked at 300 families who had married here in England since they became devotees. And only 15 of them were with the same husband, the same wife. So, you know, it's mostly Western devotees. And they're married and divorced. I mean, you just think, you know, some of the older devotees, just think about how many older devotees that you know were married. And consider how many of them have divorced. Most of them. Almost all of them. Two rare cases. The people we were with today, 40 or 50 or so people, I don't know if one family there hadn't divorced. In some cases, two or three times. And in several cases, not only have they divorced and divorced and divorced, now they're still, I mean, they're separated or with nobody again. I mean, it's overwhelming. We're going to be inspired when they look close and see if that kind of thing is going on. I mean, hopefully now in the last 5 years it looks like the marriages are more secure. We hope so. At least for now. Give another 4 or 5 years and you'll see how much these people, you know, are still together. But it's a sign that we do have to be much more real and communicate better. Be less selfish. Because even similar to the divorce is somehow both or one party not being able to really deeply try to understand and help and support the other person sufficiently. So what happens? Okay. You're the wrong person. This man, this woman could be better for me, fulfill more of my needs. So you get out of here. I want to take another husband, another wife. Just to find another kind of other additional problems. Relationship means work. No silver bullet when it comes to relationships. But I mean, sociologically speaking, it's a disaster. 300 families, only 15 people, like 5%. Take a roster and look at devotees who were around 10, 15 years ago, who got married. We follow them. So, where's your husband? Oh, which one? that's person. Are you still married? Yeah, but not to that one anymore. You mean sorry, new one? Yeah, but not to that one either. This one is not even a devotee. What's that? So, you know, let's not be another statistic, you know, like that. That's what we're saying about this, you know, necessary for a healthy balance. And if we have more supportive relationships, then it helps everybody, helps everyone. It doesn't cause devotees to overreact when there's problems. Because anybody's relationship is going to have problems. With their success, people have learned how somehow to cope in spite of the problems. Better head back. They want leaving the park except us. This is a public park.
Yeah.
See, oh yeah, so much green, so many parks, so much fields. When you go into London, everything is so close and so congested. Is Khan found the charge of divine grace? Is he fucking with Arthur Swami? Is he the Rabbi Wadki? So try to think about what we talked about and just really work hard in trying to be more selfless. Work hard in trying to be more appreciative. That Prabhupada has given us some special gem. And don't think that happens to somebody else. It happens to somebody else that they come and they bloop and they give up Krishna consciousness and become angry. It can happen to any of us. We let Maya sneak in on us. Once Maya comes in, she finds a way to gradually take over. Don't be another statistic who commits suicide, another statistic that had, you know, divorced. Be a statistic that people can say, wow, really nice family, really devotional, they're quite sane, they, you know, they have vision, they have focus.